In other words, if Reconstruction is so toxic, and if the racist forces are so dominating the narrative, to even be able to nod towards it as something that might be ambiguous or open ended, might be a kind of intentional, defensive, strategic move.
Yeah. That's the idea of the last African American in Congress leaves office in 1901, and he gives a speech saying the Negro has been traduced, and we are not like those earlier office holders who were totally corrupt and drunken all the time. And I don't know what to make of that, right? Like, what I can't gauge in this discourse is to what extent are we seeing, after 30 years of hearing this, they've come to believe it, that their forefathers were actually corrupt. To what extent is it a rhetorically useful, I'm not like that guy?
Right.
I mean, is that sort of what you're alluding to, or?
It could be something like that, maybe more specifically. Mm-hmm. You know, this can apply differently to different authors, of course, but one sort of chestnut in the Conjure Tales is so general and about historically placing his work. That might be, like Chestnut, I can see that being something, that might be like Twain and Huck Finn sort of playing with Reconstruction in a similar way,
right,
marking the thing he can't really talk about. Mm-hmm. And in that way, maybe he's given up on trying to convince, you know, the average reader in his day, but maybe he's hoping that someone out there might take up his clue, us, or, you know, someone else.
No, that's great. I had never thought about Twain, of course. I mean, I thought about it in a different context, but Twain, of course, being similarly, like, and so the question would be, you would know the answer to this, how many things are set vaguely after the Civil War rather than specifically with Reconstruction era markers?
In fiction?
Yeah. I mean, is that just the normal trope to be like a couple years after the war?
I think the chronology tends to be pretty vague.
Yeah.
I think that's right. But that's not a scientific assessment.
That's really interesting.
Is there any way to get kind of the reception of the novels, and were they reviewed in any of like the African American papers at the time, or? I always like to know, you know, how people read things that are published. And
right. So, I mean that's a good question. What I'm flashing on is when Hopkins reviews her own work in under different aliases. Yeah, I should.
Did she give it a good review?
What kind of question is that?
Yes. Right, because the question, I should look into that. The question would be whether they say, what about, you know, this is unfair. I guess what I'm still thinking through something that Mo raised. I guess what we're seeing maybe it's wrong for me to lump all these authors together, because Chestnut is clearly trying to work in a Howells tradition and wants to be a serious novelist. And so it would make sense that he would write like Twain and not be too specific about the historical details, because he can't be seen to be writing from a particular racial interest. He needs to be sort of writing in the general universal, right?
Okay.
Whereas somebody like Hopkins and Harper are still working in the kind of reformist vein. So it's not, in the end, surprising that Chestnut, my argument is unraveling as Moe's question unfolds in me, because it's not surprising then that Chestnut would do that. But it is still, I think, surprising that Hopkins and Harper do it. I guess the other thing I'm thinking about, though, when we think about, and this is sort of an historiographical question, is to what extent did people really experience Reconstruction, mm-hmm. right? I mean, at the time versus, you know, later it gets remembered as this, like, you know, this jackboot of the Northern Army all over the South. But, I mean, no. I mean, the Union troops were barely there. And so, you know, like when I say, oh, it's striking that Twain or Chestnut efface the particulars of Reconstruction, there aren't these obvious markers that were in a Reconstruction moment. Well, how often would those markers have been for someone?
For an African American audience?
Well, that would mm-hmm. be the difference. I mean, presumably African Americans experience Reconstruction much more. Right. Okay. So that would separate Chestnut and Twain again. Yeah.
I'm thinking about the Mayor of Tradition and, like, the real difference between history and fiction that we see, since he wrote the Mayor of Tradition explicitly about the Wilmington race riots.
Right.
And so when you're talking about, like, the editorials, that was based off of the real-life editor, Alexander Manley, I think his
mm-hmm.
name was.
Mm-hmm.
But then we have Josh Green, the fictional character, and I think we have a moment when he's recounting the death of his parents,
mm-hmm.
and they were lynched, or
mm-hmm.
I think his father was lynched, his mother was driven insane
mm-hmm.
by the KKK, or
mm-hmm.
some invocation of that. So I think, you know, that is a moment in which we see, like, the realities of Reconstruction for this, like, particular subset of, like, lower-class African-Americans, because, you know, Josh Green is set as a complete antithesis to Dr. Miller.
Yes.
And so I think that's a moment in which we actually see the limitations of Reconstruction in the novel, because you're right in that the rest of the novel is seemingly set in the 1890s,
uh-huh.
and Dr. Miller was like, oh, I thought they were, you know, that Reconstruction wasn't that bad. Like, he actually says or thinks that in direct response to Josh Green's story. So I'm wondering, you know, how you see that and, like, the whole figure of Alexander Manley fitting into the trajectory of your argument.
So what happens with Josh Green, right, is that he witnesses a lynching and it stays with him as a traumatic memory that will shape his entire life, right? That's a very familiar model for thinking about African-American experience, right? That there was an originary trauma which continues. I'm not remembering that being specifically key to Reconstruction. That seems like a lynching. Because one thing that seems interesting when Chestnut talks about lynching is that it's really, I mean, I don't think of lynching as such an antebellum phenomenon, but he kind of projects it back, he projects it forward. It is like the nature of what it means to be black, is to be under the threat of lynching at all times. So, but you remembered it specifically being Reconstruction?
Well, I think with the timeline of the novel, because if it's set in like
right.
the 1890s, and I think he's in his mid-30s.
Right.
Right.
And he's thinking back when he was...
Right.
A child.
Right.
So
and that happens in Contending Forces, too. A character
mm-hmm.
shows up to recount how her whole family was lynched back in Reconstruction. So, yeah. So that would be... But that's an example of Reconstruction's failures,
right?
Mm-hmm. Not... Right. Right. So, one possibility is... I mean, I've been prompted to think about this as a literary project, right? Like, what is it that the novel has trouble accommodating? And one theory I have is that... The novel works very comfortably with a reformist model of politics, obviously, because a reformist model of politics is all about changing the hearts and minds of other people. Novels do that really well. Another kind of model of politics, which I think is the Reconstruction era model, Reconstruction model of politics, there's no obvious place for fiction in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so one theory I've been sort of operating with is like, well, yeah, of course the novel gets deranged by Reconstruction, because how do you depict a state apparatus exercising jurisdiction? That's a really hard thing to represent, and so most people aren't up to it. Another possibility, though, is that this is just fundamentally not a literary question, and who cares what goes on in these novels? The real problem is, where do we see Reconstruction in the political philosophy of this generation of leaders, right? Because one thing I think we see in the fiction of this period is a real authoritarianism. I mean, one thing that I didn't get a chance to talk about in Iola Leroy is that along with all of the denigration of voting as always corrupt, then you have the happy alternative, which is the conversazione. If you remember, like, where the men and women get together. And what's great about a conversazione is that women are there, too, and they can all share ideas. But what's striking about a conversazione is that nobody disagrees. Like, they give one talk after another, and everyone says, yes. And there's just, like, one moment where a Southern man shows up and says, you know, my race is better than your race, and he just has to leave, and then they go back to, yes. And so there's something, like, really anti-democratic. So, I mean, one thing to think about would be, maybe what I really want to say is, it's not about literature. This is about... let's think through the implications of Reconstruction and how it shapes people's thought, which is clearly Du Bois. And then, so I guess I'm just canvassing now for general thoughts. What do you think about democracy? What is the standard take? I've not asked myself this question. But what's the standard take on African American activists' views of democracy in the early 20th century? Or... because, you know, a lot of these utopias that they have are super authoritarian also.
Yeah, so. Griggs.
Yeah, right. So maybe that's sort of the point of Reconstruction. Maybe that's part of it.
Du Bois' big theme in Black Reconstruction is that's the ultimate, you know, representation of democracy was Reconstruction.
But the ideology of uplift, there was always that tension, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's much more proletarian oriented in Black Reconstruction than.
I would say don't give up on the literary.
You think so?
I think it's, I mean, even if it fails, it's interesting to watch it fail.
Okay. So you think, I mean, are you persuaded there's a phenomenon that I'm talking about?
Yeah, I mean, okay. Yes, but I...
Because you were unraveling me. You were like, oh, it's just like Twain. It's like normal, not to mention Reconstruction.
Well, I guess, you know, because you're in... This is just my sort of unprocessed reaction, is because you're working against Warren, or not against so much, but in terms of Warren, you're having to paint in large brushstrokes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you get into the individual text, there'll be more opportunities in different contexts to make some distinctions, and maybe Chestnut isn't...
Is
sort of a... A variation on the rule. Because even if he is talking about Reconstruction by not talking about it, that's still very different than the model that doesn't exist that you were sort of talking about, which would be, you know, a novel about a wonderful, you know, African-American bureaucrat who was really doing a great job with the paperwork, and then wasn't, you know, racism didn't allow him to save the town's budget.
That would be a great novel. That is what I would like. Yeah.
Well, I just want to comment on some of the text that you mentioned that I've read before, too, and just the interesting ways in which the extent to which Reconstruction is talked about but not talked about directly. For example, a lot of the authors may be pointing to some particularly new ways that they're thinking about racial uplift, such as the idea that race leaders and those in professional positions or office holding positions, that can't coexist, that it's impossible perhaps to be a race leader and to be in a professional position or to hold office, and just thinking about the endings of texts such as Charles Chestnut's book dealing with the riot, the Wilmington riot. It ends in the home, I believe, with that interaction between the two daughters and the idea that there's this emphasis on democracy beginning in the home, morality as central to racial uplift, and the same thing occurs with some of Harper's text as well. There's a focus on race leaders being teachers or are working on the ground. So I do see a historical message or a new historical way of thinking emerging from the text too. That may not be too tied to the literature side, but there is clearly a leaning towards activism being more on the ground or beginning in the home, beginning with that morality theme as important.
I think that's right, and I think that's a return to what I take to be kind of pre-Reconstruction models of reform, right? Because, I mean, that's a very standard antebellum way. It's like Beth Harriet Beecher Stowe, right? It starts in the home.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's right. Have you read Contending Forces?
I haven't, but I will
you
definitely
would love it.
Soon.
It's on your list.
Yeah, it is, actually.
follow up on that, though, because, I mean, you know, it is worth noting that you've got two female authors that you're talking about in this, you know, and then, and what's Reconstruction about? I mean, yes, there is an empowerment of black women to some extent during Reconstruction, but really, really the focus on who has political power in Reconstruction is black men. So there is something to be said about what happens when female authors have to turn to that particular...
Right. That's actually why I asked you if you had read Contending Forces. Okay, so here's something I'm having trouble teasing out. Du Bois should be in this, right? Because if anyone does anything to defend Reconstruction in his non-fictional writings, I mean, setting aside black Reconstruction, but just the souls of black folk. I mean, I got interested in Reconstruction because of that essay about the Yankee school teachers, which is just so moving. And his essay on the Freedmen's Bureau. I mean, these are, you know, the Freedmen's Bureau is hard to defend, and he makes it beautiful. And yet, if you read The Silver Fleece, it offers the exact same kind of account, I think, you should tell me what you're thinking, of everyday politics that you get in Contending Forces, which is like it's dominated by women, it's all backroom dealing. So it's bad because it's backroom dealing instead of like, you know, democratically whatever, and it's bad because it's in the hands of women. So you have Du Bois saying that, you have Hopkins saying that, although she kind of can't mean it in exactly the same way he does. So there's something about the feminization, that electoral, that when, maybe this is my theory, when African-American men are disenfranchised all along the South, the only route to political power is certain elites in the Republican Party who are playing for certain civil service positions, certain kinds of appointments, and that all seems to happen under the aegis of women. That seems like, that is figured as being part of like salon socializing. And so somehow there's what you're saying, which is that there's women are being excluded from electoral politics. And on the other hand, what's taken the place of electoral politics is too feminized. And it's that, there's, so gender's all over this in a way that I think you'll find really interesting. That's why I recommend it. Well, I think we have a reception.
Yes, we did. Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, here. Oh.